Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, a special episode, part one of our GitLit Festival preview. GitLit is Spokane's annual literary festival, featuring a full week of readings, panels, workshops, and events with authors of local and national renown. This year's festival is April 22nd through 28th at locations throughout Spokane. Tonight on The Bookshelf, we're featuring readings by three local authors, plus an excerpt from an interview with Tommy Orange, author of the best-selling novel There, There, and one of the headliners of this year's GitLit Festival. But first, Simeon Mills, a writer, cartoonist, and teacher. His graphic novel, Butcher Paper, received a 2010 Artist Trust grant and is currently available from Scablands Books. His new novel, The Obsoletes, is forthcoming in May from Skybound Books.
I am Simeon Mills, and I have a new novel out that's called The Obsoletes, and it's coming out on May 14th. And it's a novel about a pair of teenage brothers who have a secret, and the secret is that they're robots. And if anyone discovers who they are, they can be destroyed. The novel takes place in the early 90s in a small town in Michigan, which is very similar to the small town that I grew up in. I have a few events that I'll be at Get Lit this year. The first is a panel on Friday, April 26th. It's called Fiction Writers Breaking New Ground, and it's at 9:30 at Spokane Falls Community College. I'll be there with Lena Crow, Christian Lundstrom, and Lainey Zumas. On Saturday, April 27th, I'll be at another panel called No Normal, Wacky and Unpredictable, and Even Hella Frustrating, Pathways to Success. That's at 1:30 at the Montvale Event Center, and I'll be there with Amy Ratto Parks, Jeremy N. Smith, Rob Schlegel, Sharma Shields, and Keisha Llewellyn Schlegel. Now I am going to read from the first chapter of The Obsoletes. Our bus driver was a robot. Ask any kid on bus 117. Not that any of them had for sure seen a real robot before Mrs. Stover. That they knew about, anyway. But that didn't stop them from whispering a mountain of evidence against her. She doesn't eat. Not even the day after Halloween when I gave her a Twix just to see if she'd eat it. She didn't. Mrs. Stover drinks too much coffee, just like a robot. And her hair, its wires, it just sits up there. I heard robots eat cigarettes. Her breath smells just like my grandma's house. Her glasses are too big for a human. Has anyone ever seen her out of her bus seat? Because it's like she's connected to the bus, like they're two parts of the same big machine. And Magic Johnson. I was about to say Magic Johnson. It was true. Mrs. Stover had a computer-like obsession with Magic Johnson, sworn enemy of our favorite team, the Detroit Pistons. All of Mrs. Stover's clothes were Lakers purple. One poor kid even saw a purple bra strap once. She had pictures of Magic tucked into the leather sun visor above her seat. Lakers earrings, Lakers fingernail polish, a Lakers thermos. There was a price of admission for boarding Mrs. Stover's bus. Tell her a fact about Magic Johnson. Some kids gave the same answer every day. He wears purple. That was enough. Those kids could sit wherever they wanted. But if you were a new kid, if you stepped onto her bus and knew nothing about Magic Johnson, you had to sit directly behind Mrs. Stover for the duration of the ride. You had to listen. Scratch that. The entire bus had to listen to Mrs. Stover's booming voice announcing highlights from the previous night's Lakers game, or, if it was the off-season, endless trivia about Magic Johnson in frantic shouts. Grew up down the road in Lansing. A short pause. Led Michigan State to its first national championship. Kids held their breath, wincing. Finals MVP his rookie season. James Boddy was the first to realize she was a robot. Surprisingly, the tell had nothing to do with Magic Johnson. Instead, James pointed out the writing on the back of Mrs. Stover's shoes. It was a foreign language, an entire foreign alphabet. We all snuck peeks to the front of the bus, where Mrs. Stover's shoes worked the pedals. There was the writing, easy to confirm, yet impossible to explain. Robots are built with parts from other countries, James whispered. Countries like China. Everyone gasped, China. That discovery occurred the first week of fourth grade. It was 1986. By the following spring, Mrs. Stover is a robot had yet to be replaced on our bus by anything even half as interesting to talk about. New theories and observations sprang up daily to be debated, scrutinized, and, if validated by James Boddy, our official robot expert, formally recorded in Molly Seed's spiral notebook. Molly sat with James in the back of the bus. She was his second in command, his vice president, and his secretary all in one. Molly's notebook contained every scrap of evidence against Mrs. Stover, page after page, written in superb handwriting, flawless, even by girl standards. She guarded the notebook with her life. James was the only other person permitted to hold it. To Molly, the rumor about Mrs. Stover went beyond gossip. There was an inevitable conclusion, a purpose to her methodical data collection. On the last day of school, she and James would submit their findings to the principal. Mrs. Stover would be deemed obsolete for failing to hide her robotic identity, and, per the informal agreement between the robotics companies and the general public, Mrs. Stover's life would be forfeit. She would be destroyed. Immediately. The best part was that anyone could annihilate an obsolete robot. It was first come, first served, and the kids on bus 117 had some original ideas. As the last day of school approached, killing our bus driver was all anyone talked about. We'll buy a bazooka and fill it with dynamite, then we'll handcuff Mrs. Stover to the back of the bus, then we'll... This is serious, you guys, Molly whispered. She had no patience for methods that were silly or fun. She was ruthless, a professional. Her tiny glasses, tiny nose, and general overall smallness only added to the effect. While James Boddy was fascinated by robots, Molly Seed simply hated them. She was a robophobe to her core. For whatever reason, my twin brother Kanga was in love with Molly Seed. Fourth grade was a do-or-die year for Kanga and me. A couple of months earlier, our parents actually did turn obsolete and vanish. One morning, they were here, moving about our apartment in routine fashion, watching TV, drinking coffee, wiping grease from their armpits, waving goodbye as we left for the bus stop. When we got home that afternoon, they were gone. Kanga and I stood in the living room, suddenly huge with neither mom nor dad in it. Their possessions remained throughout the apartment, but in place of their bodies was the faint odor of sawdust. My central processor was overloaded, and I made the error of offering my brother a logical explanation for our parents' sudden disappearance. Mom and Dad must have realized they were obsolete. I mean, they were programmed to raise us, but that's over. We don't need them anymore. So I bet they just stopped whatever they were doing, got into Dad's van, and drove to Detroit, to the address in the back of the directions where obsolete robots are supposed to go. Maybe it's a laboratory. Maybe it's just a dump. Don't say that! Kanga plugged his ears with his thumbs. Mom and Dad aren't in a dump. They would never just leave us. Somebody... He spun around and ran into the kitchenette, as if Mom might be hiding there. Then he darted into Mom and Dad's bedroom. Somebody must have kidnapped them. Somebody's got them in their basement all chained up. We gotta save them, Daryl. It's important to note that Kanga and I were not identical twins. I was taller by an inch. He had a widow's peak. My wrists were a constellation of freckles. Kanga had twin birthmarks on each shoulder. And, not to put too fine a point on it, I was the good robot, and Kanga was, let's say, unique. While I fully understood that our existence was a result of a grand social experiment that required us to covertly navigate our environment, to interact with our human peers just enough to appear human ourselves, to speak sentences to them, but only after having listened to 100 sentences spoken by them, and, above all else, to avoid detection, Kanga simply believed he was human. My brother's denial was Mom's fault. She never mentioned the word robot in his presence, because Kanga's eyelids would malfunction at the acknowledgement of what we really were. So she just stopped doing it. Mom still got Kanga to do everything normal robots did. Drink lots of fluids, insert a food receptacle before eating, plug his fingers into an outlet every night, etc. but she acted like every family in our apartment building was doing that too. She probably convinced herself that Kanga's existential delusion was somehow an asset to his survival. She loved him, after all. But now Mom was gone, and Dad along with her. I was the new Mom, and if I were going to persuade Kanga to accept that he was a robot, it wouldn't happen overnight. "Look around," I said the day Mom and Dad disappeared. "Do you see any signs of struggle here? They weren't kidnapped, Kanga. They left on their own. Obsolescence," I had to choose my words carefully. "Obsolescence happens all the time to parents. It's part of life. Mom and Dad did a fantastic job raising us, but that job is over. They're retired. Haven't they earned it? I'm sure they still love us, wherever they are." Kanga crossed his arms. "I'm going to find them." "Look," my patience was gone. "Obsolescence is forever, Kanga. We don't need Mom and Dad anymore. They don't need us. Besides, obsolete people are a danger to themselves and everybody around them. It's spelled out very clearly in The Directions on page 593. Do I need to read that section to you?" "No." "Because I can. Our copy of The Directions is right over." "Don't. Please." I was playing dirty. The Directions was a how-to guide for being a robot, specifically for being us, a pair of Detroit 600s, and our parents, but they were mere 400 series models. I read it to understand my strengths and weaknesses, my capabilities and functions. Kanga avoided it for the same reasons. Reading it to us, Mom had always substituted the word person for robot, a practice I shamefully continued after she'd left. If nothing else, The Directions was a tool to get Kanga in line, a threat. And maybe somewhere deep in his processor, he was listening, putting together the pieces of just how different we were from everybody else.
That was Simeon Mills, reading from his forthcoming novel, The Obsoletes. You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. This episode, we're showcasing a selection of the authors participating in Spokane's annual Get Lit Literary Festival. Next up, Ellie Kozlowski, poet and author of the new book, Best Tent Camping Washington.
My name is Ellie Kozlowski. I'll be reading at Get Lit's MFA alumni reading on Sunday, April 28th. Today, I am going to read an excerpt from my book, Best Tent Camping Washington. This comes from Little Pend d'Oreille National Wildlife Refuge Campgrounds. From the populated west side of the Cascades, the refuge should not be considered unless you have a full week to devote to getting there and being there. Just southeast of Colville and less than 2 hours north of Spokane, Little Pend d'Oreille National Wildlife Refuge is a 40,200-acre tract on the western slope of the Selkirk Mountains, and easily a good day's drive from Seattle. It has the distinction of being the only mountainous mixed conifer preserve in the United States, not including Alaska, with 6 distinct forest zones. The preserve is unquestionably worthy of the drive, but is most enjoyable with a little advanced planning. And that's just the beginning of the superlatives describing the sanctuary, remarkable not only for its ongoing wildlife preservation and restoration efforts, but also for the aura of serenity that seems to settle on you like a comforting blanket almost as soon as you arrive. It's a place where you find yourself whispering a lot and feeling guilty about the automobile noise. Driving faster than 10 miles per hour seems reckless. Going slowly induces a kind of reverence, in essence, with a bit of breathless anticipation thrown in. As you might imagine, birds are the focal point around the refuge. More than 180 species have been identified, from the bald eagle who winters on Little Pend d'Oreille River to the warbling vireo who makes its summer home in the refuge but flies south to Central America for the winter. The refuge maintains a checklist of birds known or anticipated to spend time there in any given season. Wildlife viewing ranks at the top of my personal list of reasons to camp at Little Pend d'Oreille National Wildlife Refuge, and as I write this entry, I am mentally planning my trip back there soon.
That was Ellie Kozlowski, reading from her book, Best Tent Camping Washington. This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. featuring a preview of the Get Lit Festival, taking place in Spokane, April 22nd through 28th, 2019. Next up, Tim Greenup, author of the poetry collection Without Warning, published by Scablands Books in 2016.
Hi, I'm Tim Greenup. I'm a writer. This year during Get Lit, I am part of a panel on contemporary comics that is happening at the SCC campus on Friday, April 26th from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. On that panel, I'll be talking about a self-published zine that I made with my wife, Kate Reed. This zine is called The Mall, and it is about the mall. It features poems that I wrote and illustrations by Kate Reed that are inspired in various ways by the poems, though they're not like direct interpretations of those poems. They're kind of their own thing. So the book pairs words and images in a sort of comic-y way, but it's definitely not your traditional superhero comic. And this was inspired during one of those smoky wildfire days that we had last summer. We went out to the Spokane Valley Mall just to sort of get out of the house, and just sort of walking around the mall for a couple of hours was a very like sort of nostalgic experience, and reminded me of being a teenager when like my parents would drop me off at the mall and I'd just spend hours there not really doing anything but feeling grown up because I was sort of out in the world on my own. So I'm going to read a couple of poems from the zine. And this first one is called Aladdin's Castle. And Aladdin's Castle was a like part of a chain of arcades that was around in the like late 80s, early 90s, which was my prime mall days. This poem's called Aladdin's Castle. Right now, you're John Connor in Terminator 2. Your hair covers your dark eyes and you hate your parents. You're inside the cockpit of an afterburner arcade game. Unlike John, you don't have a red-headed punk friend to rob ATMs with or warn you of the dangers to come. You're alone with $1.75 to burn. You wonder when a tall man in sunglasses and leather jacket will walk down the bland hallway of your life carrying a bouquet of red roses, and how long it will take for the roses to scatter to the floor, revealing a large black gun. And once you see the gun, how long till it starts firing, disrupting everything you thought you knew about the world. It will finally be your turn to shake on the cold ground in fear until the strong man grabs you by your backpack and rushes you to a California desert. There you'll discover who you really are. Geez, you think, it could take hours. You rock back and forth in the plastic cockpit. You watch the high scores scroll. This next poem I'm going to read is called Atrium. And just like some context for this poem, one of the things that happened, I guess, when I was writing the poems for this book was I was thinking a lot of like the late 80s, early 90s, and what it was like growing up in that time. And one of the things that stands out to me is like stranger danger, sort of this like rampant fear that parents had during that time that their kids were going to be just like kidnapped at any moment by a random stranger. And that fear was kind of like passed on to us kids. So we just sort of needed to be distrustful of anybody we don't know. So stranger danger sort of factors into this poem. You're on a small carpeted stage playing with plastic dinosaurs. The chlorine smell from the nearby fountain wraps you like a bathrobe in winter. Your mother sits behind a neon pink sign. It reads, nails. Paper masks cover half the mouths in there. Who knows how long you'll be out here waiting? Who knows who will grab you and throw you into the trunk of a blue Pontiac? Who knows what kind of field they'll drive you to? Who knows what you'll be made to do with your body, if you'll be threatened with a knife, gun, or something new? Who knows if you'll ever leave that field, which you realize with sudden blinding clarity will be a field of tall corn?
That was Tim Greenup, reading from his self-published comic zine, The Mall. This is a special Get Lit Festival preview episode of The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. One of the headlining authors of this year's festival is Tommy Orange, author of the New York Times best-selling novel, They're There. Last week, he joined me via phone to talk about his book, which is a prismatic portrait of Native American life in urban Oakland. Tommy Orange, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the book itself first. I want to start with the structure of it because it's really unique. And each chapter changes character perspective, which to me seems like you really set yourself a challenge as a writer to kind of convince the reader each time they turn to a new chapter to really buy into and empathize with a new character. So can you talk about that challenge from a writing perspective? Like, how did you get the reader into each character?
I think I wanted, this was the book that I wanted to write structurally from the get-go. It wasn't like I thought that I wanted to write like an urban native Oakland novel and how will I do it. It was falling in love with what novels can do and then trying to figure out what's the most interesting structure. I knew I wanted to write from a bunch of different perspectives and figure out how their lives converge. And there were a few books that made me want to do that, particularly Colin McCann's Let the Great World Spin. His book structure sort of is the inverse of mine. So you get a prologue at the beginning where the main event of a guy walking across the two twin towers on a tightrope. But you find out after that 7-page beautiful prologue how all the characters relate to that central sort of image. And so mine works the opposite. You're sort of finding out in the end how they all connect. So reading a book like that, I just really loved the experience of that structure and wanted to try to do something like it. I knew that the challenge was just writing a book at all. You know, trying at art is scary and a little stupid, especially if you're naturally self-loathing. And but you know, I certainly didn't think of it as a challenge particularly structure-wise. It was something that I really wanted to do because it's more out of passion for literature and a particular type of literature.
And it's interesting you talk about that other book that sort of starts with the event and then expands out, because you have to build this trust with your reader through the strength of your characters to sort of get them through basically the first half of the book, which is a new character every single chapter. We don't return to another character again until about halfway through. So did you struggle with, you know, novel drive in terms of getting your plot moving in that way?
You know, I know a lot of readers don't like going from chapter to chapter and changing characters and sort of losing sight of investment. But I do like that experience. But I did try to earn, as you transition from chapter to chapter, I did try to earn some sense of reader magnetism or something, like compellability. Like, so you go from Tony, who frames the powwow, the first chapter, you find out that he's possibly going to be involved with robbing a powwow, just right, as a basic premise. And then we move to Dean Oxendine, who also frames it in the sense that we're capturing Oakland stories. And then we move to Opal, the Opal chapter, back in time, and it's almost as if this is one of the stories. So it does have a thread that is, it's not totally obvious, but it's also not like you're jumping to, you know, Thailand all of a sudden.
Right.
You're a white businessman. Like, there is some reason to believe that the author is going somewhere. I tried to earn that at least.
My guest today is Tommy Orange, author of the New York Times best-selling novel, They're There, and one of the headlining authors of this year's Get Lit Festival here in Spokane. So a lot of this book deals with Native identity and with Oakland, and several of the characters struggle with not feeling Indian enough or not learning about their Native heritage from their family. So what was your own connection to being Native American growing up, and how did you work that into your characters?
So my dad is from Oklahoma. He's a fluent Cheyenne speaker, and his background is being raised by his great-grandparents and a little more of a traditional, what you would think of as a traditional Native upbringing. And then my mom's white, and we go, I think, three generations back in Oakland. So I very much had a biracial experience in that both sides were informing who I was, and I never felt entirely enough like either side. So, you know, we'd go back to Oklahoma to visit relatives, and it was always very clear from the get-go that I am Native. I think all Native people struggle with what it means to be authentically Native, because mm-hmm. it's been used as a tool for erasure to have there only be one way and to have this blood quantum come into play. And so it's just complex and nuanced, and I wanted to explore in a prismatic way all the different ways that people experience their Native identity and do it through these characters who are fictional characters but very much informed by various different kinds of experience I had working in Oakland and growing up in Oakland.
So speaking of that sort of broader Native experience, another unique feature of this novel is the prologue and the interlude, which are essentially nonfiction essays which place the fictional events of the book within a broader historical and cultural context. So I just wanted to sort of get a little bit of the sound of the voice of either the prologue or the interlude. So would you be willing to read just a page or two from one or the other?
Sure. There's a part of the prologue that came out the first year of writing the book, and I think is would make sense to read here because it's the end of the prologue. It's called Urbanity. Urban Indians were the generation born in the city. We've been moving for a long time, but the land moves with you like memory. An urban Indian belongs to the city, and cities belong to the earth. Everything here is formed in relation to every other living and non-living thing from the earth. All our relations. The process that brings anything to its current form, chemical, synthetic, technological, or otherwise, doesn't make the product not a product of the living earth. Buildings, freeways, cars, are these not of the earth? Were they shipped in from Mars, the moon? Is it because they're processed, manufactured, or that we handle them? Are we so different? Were we at one time not something else entirely? Homo sapiens, single-celled organisms, space dust, unidentifiable pre-bang quantum theory? Cities form in the same way as galaxies. Urban Indians feel at home, walking in the shadow of a downtown building. We came to know the downtown Oakland skyline better than we did any sacred mountain range, the redwoods in the Oakland hills better than any other deep wild forest. We know the sound of the freeway better than we do rivers, the howl of distant trains better than wolf howls. We know the smell of gas and freshly wet concrete and burned rubber better than we do the smell of cedar or sage or even fry bread, which isn't traditional, like reservations aren't traditional, but nothing is original. Everything comes from something that came before, which was once nothing. Everything is new and doomed. We ride buses, trains, and cars across over and under concrete plains. Being Indian has never been about returning to the land. The land is everywhere or nowhere.
That was my guest, Tommy Orange, reading from his book, There, There. He'll be in Spokane this month for the Get Lit Festival, reading on Wednesday, April 24th, 7 p.m. at Spokane Community College, and on Thursday, April 25th at Pie and Whiskey at the Washington Cracker Company building in Spokane. And Tommy Orange, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. For more information about Spokane's Get Lit Festival, featuring all of the authors in tonight's episode, plus many more, visit getlitfestival.org. For Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini.